previously on the seventh day.
But to find the real heart of the pro-Sunday movement, we have to shift our focus from Alexandria westward to the heart of the Roman Empire.
It's especially significant that New Testament writers never refer to the first day of the week as a Sabbath.
Sympathetic biographers claim that before a climactic battle near Rome, Constantine saw a vision of a flaming cross in the sky. He credited this vision with his subsequent victory and declared himself to be a Christian. Historians debate whether or not Constantine's conversion was genuine.
And now, part five of the seventh day, Revelations from the Lost Pages of History.
I am Patrick, a sinner most unlearned, the least of all the faithful, and utterly despised by many. My father was Calpomius, a deacon, son of Potitius, a priest of the village of Banavum Taburnia. He had a country seat nearby, and there I was taken captive. I was then about 16 years of age. I did not know the true God. I was taken into captivity to Ireland with many thousands of people, and deservedly so, because we turned away from God and did not keep his commandments.
This is a copy of St. Patrick's Confession, the testimony of a man who is often considered the most famous Irishman of all time. But myths and legends often obscure his true identity. Was he a great miracle-working missionary to Ireland? Was he the one who chased the snakes off the Emerald Isle? Who was he, really? We're about to see the St. Patrick of history, quite a different man from the Patrick of legend and tradition. And we'll soon go on to uncover more about the long, drawn-out effort to replace the biblical Sabbath with Sunday as a universal Christian day of worship. Patrick was born in late 4th century Scotland into a Celtic Christian culture. His religion was quite different from the Latin or Roman Christianity that was taking over in other parts of Western Europe.
We don't really know who the first Celtic Christians were. We don't seem to know who brought Christianity to them. We're not even certain when all of that began. But what we do know is what they believed, based on the writings of Patrick and the others. And we know that what they believed was based on their understanding of Scripture.
Unlike the theologians of Roman Christianity, who appealed more and more to the teachings of church and councils, Celtic teachers stressed the Bible.
This loyalty to the Bible is what separated the Celtic Christians from the much larger Roman Christian community. Because the Bible was the foundation of their faith, it was difficult for them to accept the authority of the Roman Church. You see, the Celtic Church grew up beyond the reach of Roman influence. It was rooted in the Sabbath-keeping church that began with Jesus and his apostles back in the first century.
The background from which the Celtic Christians received their Christianity indicates to us that they were strong believers in what the scriptures said. They wanted to do what the Bible told them to do. That same background indicates for us that they got their Christianity before Sunday keeping came into vogue.
There is nothing in Patrick's works which indicates his acceptance of the teachings of church fathers. He appealed solely to the scriptures in support of what he believed, practiced, and propagated.
So this was Patrick's religion, based on the Bible, faithful to its teachings and obedient to its commandments. This was the religion he was destined to carry to the Irish. Kidnapped by raiders, Patrick and thousands of others found themselves carried off to Ireland to be sold like so much livestock. There he spent 6 long years working for a farmer as a slave.
Every day I had to tend sheep, and many times a day I prayed. The love of God and his fear came to me more and more, and my faith was strengthened. And this even when I was staying in the woods and on the mountains, and I used to get up for prayer before daylight, through snow, through frost, through rain. And there one night I heard in my sleep a voice saying to me, "Soon you will go to your own country." And again, after a short while, I heard a voice saying to me, "See, your ship is ready." And it was not near, but at a distance of perhaps 200 miles, and I had never been there, nor did I know a living soul there. And then I took to flight, and I left the man with whom I had stayed for 6 years. And I went in the strength of God, who directed my way to my good, and I feared nothing until I came to that ship.
Patrick always believed that his escape from Ireland was directed by a divine hand. His own people received him back with the plea that he never leave them again. But God's plan for Patrick's life was not to be carried out in his homeland.
I saw in the night the vision of a man whose name was Victoricus, coming as it were from Ireland with countless letters. And he gave me one of them. And I read the opening words of the letter, which were, "The voice of the Irish." And as I read the beginning of the letter, I thought that at the same moment I heard their voice, and thus did they cry out as with one mouth, "We ask thee, boy, come and walk among us once more."
Responding to the voices of the Irish people, Patrick went back to Ireland. There, his career as a preacher and teacher eventually earned him the title of saint and placed him in the ranks of the world's best-known Christian missionaries. But something that isn't so well known about him is this. Saint Patrick kept the seventh-day Sabbath. In fact, his Sabbath-keeping became legendary. 2 centuries after his death, his biographer wrote that every seventh day, Patrick and his friend Victoricus met together for prayer and fellowship. Some historians even think that Patrick's special Sabbath day friend was actually an angel.
We really don't have to rely solely on the writings or experience of Patrick to understand the history of keeping the seventh day in Ireland. After all, ancient Irish laws governed the history of the Irish tribes for many years, and those laws stipulated that the people were to, among other things, keep the seventh-day Sabbath.
It seems to have been customary in the Celtic churches of early times to keep Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, as a day of rest from labor. They obeyed the fourth commandment literally upon the seventh day of the week. Whilst the laxity which is said to have prevailed among the Celts as to the observance of the Lord's Day cannot be excused, it may to some extent be explained. The Jewish Sabbath, the seventh day, continued to be regarded by early Christians as a day of rest, whilst the first day of the week was observed as a day of gladness in commemoration of the resurrection.
As the influence of the Roman religion increased, it gradually affected the Sabbath practice of some Celtic Christians in the British Isles. By the early 6th century, it was not unusual for Celtic believers to keep both Saturday and Sunday as holy days. That's how it was during the lifetime of Patrick's spiritual successor, an Irishman named Columba. He was a graduate of one of the schools established by Patrick. Born about 521 into a noble family, He gave up his right to the throne of Ireland and dedicated himself to a higher calling. Columba based his missionary enterprise on the rocky island of Iona. He and 12 friends reached that remote post by sailing from the west coast of Scotland in small, round boats made of animal skin. There on Iona, Columba founded a training school for missionaries who carried the Christian message to the Scottish mainland and all over Britain. In doctrine, Columba was true to his Celtic Christian roots. He kept Saturday, the seventh day, as the Sabbath, while Sunday was observed in honor of the resurrection of Christ. Columba taught his disciples to keep the Sabbath as equally sacred.
His teachings regarding the observance of the Sabbath was that his followers would go out to the edges of the island of Iona, meditate upon creation and the things of God, and read the scriptures and become spiritually charged up on that holy day.
Columba and his fellow missionaries firmly planted the Christian religion in Scotland. Their converts resisted the growing influence of Rome, which promoted Sunday as the day of worship. Columba died in 597, but his beliefs lived on for hundreds of years in the religion of the Scots. In 1070, Malcolm, King of Scotland, married Margaret, a young woman who was destined to become more famous than her husband. She made her mark in history primarily as a religious reformer. In fact, she was later sainted by the Roman Catholic Church.
We know that Queen Margaret grew up at the very pious court of the kings of Hungary, and then from about the age of 7 or 8, she was living at the court of Edward the Confessor of England, which was also a very pious, devoutly Catholic court.
At the English court, Margaret lived under the influence of the Benedictine monks from Canterbury. When political conditions made her family unwelcome in England, they moved to Scotland, where Margaret caught the eye of the king.
Margaret herself seems to have contemplated becoming a nun. There is an account of how unwilling she was to marry Malcolm, King of Scots, because she had wanted to dedicate herself to be, as she termed it, a bride of Christ.
Margaret's biographer does tell us that in her early life she was very devoted to the church and she was interested in becoming a religious. But when she came to Scotland and she met Malcolm, her future husband, he asked for her hand in marriage, and according to her biography, she wasn't willing, but she consented because her family requested it, and also because she believed that God was thereby giving her an opportunity to carry out his work in the Kingdom of Scotland.
Margaret found the Scottish court somewhat crude and unrefined, so she set about to change all that. She was appalled at the way folks in Scotland practiced their religion. Many still followed the doctrines and traditions brought by Columba from Ireland nearly 5 centuries earlier. There was one aspect of the people's religion that particularly upset the new queen.
When Margaret first came to Scotland, she was dissatisfied with Sunday observance as she found it. She found that lay people tended to carry on their menial labors on Sunday. They may have gone to church first, but thereafter they went about their ordinary everyday tasks, and this was something she tried to prevent.
The Queen insisted upon the single and strict observance of the Lord's Day, Sunday. People and clergy alike submitted, but without entirely giving up their reverence for Saturday.
The history of the early Christian centuries reveals a definite anti-Seventh-day Sabbath pro-Sunday movement, and church documents unmistakably identify the religious establishment at Rome as its nerve center. The Roman drive to replace the seventh-day Sabbath with Sunday got a big boost back in 321 AD. That's the year Constantine ordered state-authorized Sunday observance. Oddly enough, in spite of his professed Christianity, there was very little Christian about his first Sunday law. In fact, it sounds a lot like a call to pagan sun worship.
On the venerable Day of the Sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed.
With a sympathetic emperor on the throne, the leaders of the Roman Church gained power and influence. In their councils, they took bold steps to enforce Sunday observance and to urge desecration of the biblical Sabbath. Some of their actions took on a definite anti-Jewish flavor.
Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, rather honoring the Lord's Day, Sunday, and if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ.
These pronouncements against Judaizers referred to those who, like the Jews, refused to work on the Sabbath. Christians who did this were to be excommunicated, kicked out of the church. This extreme position against the Sabbath, combined with a strong pro-Sunday stance, became a pillar of Roman Catholic teaching. The Sabbath to Sunday change became a mark of Roman Catholic or papal authority. In 602, Pope Gregory identified Sabbath keepers with the Antichrist. He called them Judaizers because of their determination to observe the seventh day as a day for rest and worship.
It has come to my ears that certain men of perverse spirit have sown among you some things that are wrong and opposed to the holy faith, so as to forbid any work done on the Sabbath day.
Christians in the Italian city of Milan dared to openly observe the Sabbath no matter what the leadership in Rome wanted.
The Church of Milan followed the churches of the East. It seems the Saturday was held in a fair esteem. They, the churches of the East, came together on the Sabbath day to worship Jesus Christ, the Lord of the Sabbath.
Over the centuries, the attempt to establish Sunday as a substitute for the biblical Sabbath was probably only mildly successful. But the campaign was really intensified with a move that threatened to drive a deep wedge between the Eastern and Western branches of Christianity. This move involved a direct assault on the very nature and purpose of Sabbath observance.
What was this direct assault? It was a rule forbidding Christians to eat on the seventh day. In other words, a Sabbath fast. This was an anti-Jewish idea that probably originated with Marcion, a heretic who was kicked out of the church back in the second century.
Marcion wanted to discredit the Sabbath because it was an image of creation. For him, creation was an evil deed of an evil God, the God of the Old Testament. He distinguished the God of the Old Testament from the God of the New, the God of love. But the church rejected this because creation was a good deed, and the God of the Old Testament is the same with the God of the New. So he turned a celebratory day into a day of lament, and that was his intention. This is why he introduced the Sabbath fast.
In spite of its action against him, the church salvaged his fast idea and used it to make the seventh day Sabbath unappealing.
Now, this was absolutely contrary to what had been taught in Judaism. In Judaism, Sabbath was a day of feasting. In fact, to fast on the Sabbath meant to break the Sabbath. And so this was another way of distancing Christianity from Judaism.
Turning the Sabbath day into a day without food was a very effective strategy, especially since the sixth day, Friday, was also a day of fasting for many believers. In a single generation, young Christians grew up with a built-in dislike for the Sabbath, the day of fasting and gloom, and with a corresponding attraction to Sunday, the day of celebration and feasting.
It was the church in Rome that championed the fasting on Sabbath and the feasting on Sunday. In fact, in the fourth century, Pope Sylvester said that it was good to do this in contempt of the Jews.
If every Sunday is to be observed joyfully by the Christians on account of the resurrection, then every Sabbath on account of the burial is to be regarded in execration of the Jews.
In other words, Christians were told to fast on the Sabbath as an expression of their contempt for the Jews, even as an acted-out curse against them. But even this particular anti-Sabbath strategy was only partly successful. Prominent church leaders opposed it. Hippolytus, a third-century bishop, felt it was a big mistake.
Even today, some order fasting on the Sabbath, of which Christ has not spoken, dishonoring even the gospel of Christ.
There is even a report that Augustine, one of the most influential of the Roman Church Fathers, came to the defense of church members who ignored the Sabbath fast.
Some fast on Saturday, others do not. Some partake daily of the body and blood of Christ, others receive it on stated days. In regard to these and all other variable observances which may be met anywhere, one is at liberty to comply with them or not as he chooses. And there is no better rule for the wise and serious Christian in this matter than to conform to the practice which he finds prevailing in the church to which it may be his lot to come. For such a custom, if it is clearly not contrary to the faith nor to sound morality, is to be held as a thing indifferent.
The leaders in Rome were eventually successful in imposing the Sabbath fast on their followers in the Western world of Christianity. But the same could not be said for what happened in the East. Where the Orthodox influence was strongest, Eastern Christianity resisted this, and their views on the Sabbath were really quite different.
Sabbath fasting does not make any sense for the Orthodox, because the Sabbath is the day that marks two great events, the completion of creation and the completion of redemption. So Sabbath is a day of double celebration and could never be associated with fasting and lament.
This issue of the Sabbath fast may seem, from our vantage point, like a tempest in a teapot. But it became part of the struggle for power within the church, an East-West tension that would eventually rip the Christian world in two. In 692, the Emperor Justinian II called a church council in Constantinople. A controversial meeting, it's known as the Council in Trullo, named after the palace where the bishops assembled. This was the Eastern Church's big chance to strike a blow against the growing influence of the Pope in Rome.
Canon 55 of the Council of Trullo is based on one of the apostolic canons, Canon 64, and several other canons of local councils. The principle that we get out of all these canons is that you cannot fast on a festive day. Sabbath is a festive day. It celebrates two events, the completion of creation, the completion of redemption, so it could never be associated with fasting.
Those bishops could write a million laws, but they would be nothing but ink on paper without the unanimous approval of the highest officials in the church. So the bishops had to send their canons to Rome for the Pope's signature.
They were sent to the Pope because the Pope was the first patriarch, a first among equal, five equal patriarchs, who constituted the leadership of the church. As it was the custom in all councils, they had to be approved, signed by all, as a sign of their unity in faith and order. The Pope did not sign the canons of the Council of Trullo because they objected to Sabbath fasting. He was out of tune with the other churches, and that is why he did not sign. He was convicted, and therefore action, appropriate action, was taken by the emperor. He was put under house arrest.
So the council in Trullo didn't settle the issue. In the West, Christians kept the fast. In the East, they didn't. The Sabbath fast persisted as a divisive issue, a symbol of the growing tension between Constantinople and Rome.
Next time on the seventh day,
The big issue that was at stake in 1054 between East and West was the issue of authority, authority in the church.
We're told that great beasts and locusts are simply waiting to avenge the transgression of Sunday.
It's clear that loyalty to the Sabbath of the fourth commandment did not die out easily. Roman church efforts to promote the Sunday alternative continued. One novel approach took the form of a letter that supposedly came directly from heaven. A letter from heaven? Think about it. Who wouldn't want one of those to support their opinions? That'd be a pretty convincing weapon of persuasion, especially to the uneducated and superstitious people of medieval times.